Is he my prince? Is he the toad? Waiting, wondering, is getting too old. I'm gonna let down my hair, slide up my skirt. Get me up, be the biggest little flirt. Well, I might have.
Welcome to the Shame-Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame-Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
This is the Shame-Free Zone, and I'm your host, Veronica Monet. Thanks for joining me this Monday evening. It's kind of wet and rainy all over California tonight. Actually, where I am, it's been alternating between snow and rain, so a little bit chilly. And tonight, we're going to talk about a topic that actually has been on my mind a lot this week, and that is the topic of self-love. And no, I know you may think we must be going down the road about masturbation. That's not actually what we're going to be talking about. My guest this evening is Evelina Rose, and she has led workshops on intimacy and sacred sexuality for 17 years. She founded something called Love Journey, which is Tantra of the Heart, and she's evolving a community, which is developing sex-positive lifestyles. Some of her workshops are goddess-centered and incorporate goddess-centered rituals, and she's guiding people into erotic and romantic arts within a container of love, respect, and honoring. Evelina, welcome to the Shame-Free Zone.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
So, with all of those credentials about Tantra and sexuality, why is it we're not talking about masturbation tonight?
Probably because there are a whole range of chakras, not just the first one. And when you're really deeply in self-love, you're in all of those centers. So when we make love, self-love about masturbation, we're leaving out a whole lot of ourselves that can, when you include it, when you include the heart and when you learn to truly offer yourself love, then you're able to open to much more of who you really are.
So it sounds fabulous.
Mm-hmm.
How would one start? I mean, a lot of people suffer from low self-esteem. Some people even suffer from self-hatred. What would you recommend as a jumping-off point? And boy, that's really not a good choice of terms there.
a jumping-in point.
Okay, good. Better. Much better.
I think that's part of the secret, is to take time to really come into yourself, and any of the spiritual practices are a good place to begin, because where you want to be in order to love yourself is to be able to be in your heart, and where we're beating ourselves up is in our mind, in our ego mind. So as long as you're in your mind trying to learn how to love yourself, you're in the way of the process, because that's not where it's going to happen. So any practice that gets you between the thoughts, like imagery that helps you bring your light, I love this image of spiraling your light down from your head all the way down to the center of your heart. And then maybe putting your hand on your heart and telling yourself you love yourself. And even if the beginning doesn't feel true, it can become true. And by just being there and offering yourself love and then breathe it in, receive it, that can be a good place to start.
So kind of act as if?
Yeah, act as if. I had a friend who was a New Age comedian, and she said, affirmations are lies you tell yourself until they come true.
That's good. And they work.
They work. They do come true. So you start wherever you can start. If all you can do is love yourself for wishing you would love yourself, then you start there. The fact that you want to is a step on the road. And then you start noticing more when you're in those self-loathing places and do some kind of pattern interrupt. Anything that stops the thought system from going on. And people pretty much know what it's going to say anyway. It's the same voices. So, you know, if you're hearing a loop, if you're hearing what you've been hearing and it makes you feel bad, stop. Do something that stops it. It can be chanting. It could be meditating. Go run. Make nonsense sounds.
Huh.
The mantra. Anything that stops that negativity.
It kind of reminds me of how to interrupt an obsessive-compulsive pattern.
Mm-hmm. That's right. In a way, it is an obsessive-compulsive pattern. I think of those voices as coping mechanisms. Those are the systems that people set up as a child to survive whatever household they have. So it's kind of invented by a child, and a lot of times it's something like, I'll catch me doing things wrong before my dad does so I don't get in trouble when he comes home. Or if I keep myself small, then I won't threaten my mom. Things like that. So there are ways we stop ourselves, but we don't need to anymore.
Hmm.
And I find a lot of this is about touching in with the part of the personality that's running the old program. It's usually a child. So you go to that child with love, and you help them know they don't need to do that anymore. And then my work has become more and more about soul retrieval, which is basically you invite that child to come live with you in 2011. So you bring them, you age progress them, you bring them through time to now, and then they don't have to do that old program.
So what do you mean by age progress?
It's what I mean is that you, let me tell you the technique that I often use, which is to have the adult go sit with the child, whatever part is running the negative voices, and they usually find them somewhere in the past. So they invite them to come into 2011 and live in their heart. And you start with just little sentences of, I love you, and I'm here for you, and I want to take care of you. And then if they agree to come, I usually ask Divine Mother, because she knows more than I do, the Divine Feminine, to bring that part into the heart and into current time. And then they can start growing again.
The inner child can start growing again.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you've talked about putting your hand on your heart chakra and interrupting thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
Are there, like, specific exercises that somebody could do? If they're, you know, just wanting to be proactive?
Yes. One thing you can do with... the negative thoughts is to see if you can work with the part that's criticizing and encourage that part to praise you. If you can go from self-criticism to, it's like you're busy catching everything you're doing wrong, you start catching what you're doing right.
Hmm. So change your focus on the things that you want, obviously.
Yeah, change your focus to what you want, because we know that where you put your energy is what expands, what you get more of. So you start looking, even if the negative voice is going, you can go, okay, what did I do right today? Sometimes people at the end of the day will write down something like accomplishments, successes, and positive steps. So just to record a few minutes of that every evening, you start going, I'm doing some things right here. And it helps you to build a different assessment of yourself.
Well, what about some of the resistance that people have? A lot of times they may say something, express a wish, say something about themselves that isn't disparaging, and there'll be a negative response from friends or family.
Mm-hmm.
How do you advise people to deal with that? There's almost sometimes some peer pressure to feel bad about yourself.
It's true. There's peer pressure, and there can be kind of a sharing of the negative.
Yes. Women in particular I've seen do this around, oh, I'm so fat. No, you're skinny. I'm fat.
Yeah.
Or, I can't stand what I'm wearing. No, I think what you're wearing is beautiful. What I'm wearing is terrible. It's like they try to one-up each other on being unattractive.
Right. And there's sometimes a bonding through sharing wounds as well. If we share what makes us feel bad, then we're closer.
Yes. Yeah.
And I think with that, it keeps coming back to me to coming back to self. Because you hear the other person's opinion and you want to take a breath. That's a really good technique. If it feels a little off, you just take a breath, take a moment, and see what it is that you believe. And to know that it's really okay if the person has a different opinion. I think where we get ourselves kind of twisted with people being negative is that we feel that their opinion either has to become ours or we have to somehow bat it down. We have to negate it. So it's like we go to battle with it rather than going, that's an odd thing to say.
Mm.
Hmm.
Okay. So, and what is that old saying? You are what you resist.
Exactly.
Yeah. The things that we resist tend to persist.
There's a practice I've picked up that is a loving kindness practice.
Uh-huh.
And it's gotten me through so many places where the other person's doing something I'm not very interested in engaging in. And it's like, if I stay in my mind, I'm going to start fighting them or battling them. But the practice is to tune into your heart. And the question is, can I expand to include this? And the answer is often yes, I can. So I'm focused on my heart and whether I can let this be, expand to include it, and not focused on what the other person's saying. And then I get the success of feeling that I actually opened my heart. Instead of going with that judgment that was busy in my mind, because the judgment makes me want to engage. The ego always tends to work towards separation, protection and separation. But the heart wants union. So if I can ask myself this question, it helps me get in my heart, and then I feel okay. And they get to have their opinion. So I can let go of engaging in trying to convince them of anything. And I don't even have to be right. I just get to have the joy of opening my heart.
So very much about letting go, huh?
Yeah, I think it is. Letting go of what others think, whether it's what they think of you or what they're thinking. You know, when someone speaks and there's an engagement, it's fun conversation back and forth, that's great. And then if their next words happen to be negative or feels like a put down, I just want to go to that practice because I want to get myself stable okay first. You know, stable and kind of, back in my center.
That's not always an easy thing for people to do. So then part of getting back into your center is the conscious breathing techniques.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Can you describe those a little bit?
Yes. The conscious breathing is using your full breath capacity. So a good way to start is to put your hand below your navel. And it's a three-part yogic breathing that as you breathe in, the hand on your belly moves out first, and then you fill your lower lungs and then the upper lungs. And then you just allow that breath to fall out like you're emptying a vessel. So you fill the whole vessel and then you empty from the top, all three parts, and the hand on the belly comes in last. So it's that full deep breathing which will bring you more into your body, and it calms the body, it calms the nervous system, and if there's any kind of adrenaline thing going on, it helps to bring that into more calmness. It gives you, you might say, like a deeper ground from which to respond to other people. So it's really good to be doing breathing like this throughout the day, off and on, so that when you're in a situation where it would help you, you're more accustomed to having that breath. And some people like to practice the breathing like 20 minutes, twice, once a day or something. For me, I just want it to be like every 10 minutes. I take two or three breaths, you know, so that I've always got my breath informing me. And it helps me stay more present in myself. I'm not someone who came by grounding easily. I had a childhood and early life that I had many, many ways to stay out of my body. And finally, I went into therapy with someone who taught me some grounding, and he said, I think you're just going to have to admit that for the rest of your life, you'll need to ground six times a day.
Really?
Yep.
Is there some reason that you have to ground six times a day?
Because I wasn't accustomed to living in my body.
Wow.
I really knew how to dissociate. I didn't quite know very well how to associate.
So how do you, what's your schedule? You do it in the morning and before you go to bed at night?
You know, I'm not really one to have a schedule.
Okay.
I often do it before I go into a session with someone. And if I'm in a session or I'm on a phone call and I start kind of spinning out, I'll just take some breaths and ground. And I often do it if I go for a walk. I'll ground. I'll actually breathe into the earth for a few breaths. That's a wonderful calming technique. As you take several breaths where you're breathing your breath in and down into the earth, maybe through one foot for a few steps and then through the other foot. And then you take a few breaths where you're breathing the earth energy up into your body and fill with the earth energy. That's a lovely grounding. It's also very calming.
It's calming just hearing you talk about it.
So, good.
So basically, you just do this whenever you feel the need.
Mm-hmm.
Well, give us some idea of what are some of the signs you look for when you know that you are out of your body and you need to ground.
One of them is I can't feel my feet.
Oh, wow. Well, that's pretty telling, isn't it?
It is. Or I'll just kind of scan my body, and I'm mostly from the waist up or the hips up, and I'm not very much in my legs. Mm. Or I start feeling like I'm in somebody else's energy. You know, I'm talking with someone or I'm working with someone, and have you ever had that feeling that now your lips are starting to move like that person's?
Right.
That's a sign that you're not really grounded in yourself. Or I feel kind of pulled out of myself, like I'm sitting way forward and I'm getting over-engaged in their energy, and I just want to bring myself back, come back in. Another sign is running into things.
Oh my god!
So I walk through the house and I hit the door sill, or
right. What about dropping things? Being accident prone.
Yep, it's another sign. Yeah.
Why do you think people get kicked out of their bodies?
Well, I think as children, and sometimes even toddlers or infants, I think things happen when something traumatic happens. The psyche wants to protect its essence, no matter what. And my sense from having done a lot of work with people, survivors of trauma, is that the personality kind of releases the essence part in order to save it, in order to keep, it's like, I'm out of here, but not all of the self can leave and still have the body alive. So it's like a splintering, that which is so precious splinters, separates off. Hmm. So my own sense is that when traumatic things happen, the part that gets to leave is the part that later grows up and becomes spiritual and evolves, and it's not wounded by what happened. And then it has these inner kids that were wounded, that couldn't get out of the body and had to be present for the trauma. So part of loving yourself, I think, is to stop blaming yourself for doing these patterns you've been doing forever. Because all it means is part of you still caught in time. It's back in the past.
Hmm. So you're really talking about a lot of compassion.
A lot of compassion, yeah.
And patience, I would imagine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And nurturing of the inner children. I say inner children, inner child. Most people I know have more than one. And because you've got the child that got wounded, and then you've got a child that's trying to protect that child. And the part that dissociated, that's grown up. So as you love these parts of you, over time, you can help them to heal. And then I think the real challenge is to get them into current time and to reintegrate into the body, which is associating again.
Right.
It's like the body dissociated to survive, and now it gets to associate and come back together.
Now, there is a certain amount of pain that can be involved in that, yes or no?
Usually there's pain. There hadn't been a lot of pain, there wouldn't have been the splitting in the first place.
Right. So what if those kind of memories are going to come back up, or physical sensations are going to get aroused, what would you recommend people do in order to, so it won't be so frightening or overwhelming?
Well, if memories are coming up and they're in the body and it's pretty frightening, I would definitely work with a professional. I'd work with someone where you can do the memories in their office so that you can get free of having them all the time.
Mm.
Short of that, definitely a support group. What I work with more is when the memories come up, is to find the part that's in the memory and go love and nurture that part. That's a little hard to do with a person by themselves unless they've learned how to do it. And yet that's the goal, is to be compassionate with the part who's in the memory. To love them, if you can, hold them, or curl up in a ball and take care of yourself by letting yourself cry and have the feelings. If it's too much, you can always ask Kuan Yin to come in and hold you, the goddess of compassion. She absorbs a lot of suffering if you offer it to her. Or ask a friend to come. When I work with people in memories, I want them to make a list of people they can call, because when you're hurting, you won't think of anybody. But if you have a list of names and phone numbers, you might call somebody.
Right, so you want to be prepared for that moment when it happens.
If memories are coming up, you want to be prepared. It's a challenging 2 or 3 or 4 years of working through memories sometimes for people, and you want to create the support systems that can let you do that. If it's just, you know, sometimes people will like go into a past life memory. It's shorter lived, and again, it's nurturing yourself and loving yourself. I think the standard might be, if you had a friend or if you had a child that was going through this, how would you be with them? And be that way with yourself.
So, and that does bring up another question. For people who have not been parented properly, it's a little bit difficult to show up for your inner child as a loving parent. What do you have any suggestions for how people can get past that learning curve?
Well, there's a lot of workshops about loving your inner child. There's a lot of self-help books about it. I think you make it a study. If you really don't know how, then you get around people who do, either classes or support groups or therapists, or find someone who has a really loving mother and go sit with her. Ask her to teach you what it's like to have a mother's love. Ask your friend what it's like. You kind of make it a study because it's something you can learn. And what's very fascinating to me is I see people who were not mothered themselves, but were so committed to becoming a good mother that they're really good mothers to their children, and they haven't yet applied it to themselves.
Oh, yeah. A lot of that going around. People are, I think it's easier to nurture others.
That's right. That's why I say, think of how you do this with somebody else. You can apply that standard. If you found a four-year-old on the street who was totally distraught and you went, I got to take care of this child, how would you treat that child? So if you go back and you feel the part of you that's 4 years old in a memory, be that way. Be that loving adult that says, oh, sweetie, I'm here. I'm here for you. I love you. Let me hold you. And if you don't know how, you ask Divine Mother to hold you while you're holding the child and ask her to teach you. She's got a lot of practice.
Well, speaking of practice, in your workshops, what do you teach these techniques here about the inner child, or is it more focused on Tantra?
We teach some of both because I find that to learn Tantra, to learn the erotic arts, you want to be in your body. So we always teach grounding. We teach movement. We do work with body image, which helps bring up some of the places where we're not loving ourselves. And we do various things that help to increase self-love.
Let's talk about that for a little bit. Body image.
Body image is an interesting one because it allows each person to have a really safe and sacred place, a space in which she can share her feelings about her body, maybe her doubts, maybe things she doesn't like, but also things she likes. Because everyone has something about their body they like, maybe the strength in their arms or the way their cheek is shaped or something. So it helps people get more aware of their body and how they feel about it. And we have someone who demonstrates, and I think we're really good at creating a deep level of safety. And then each person shares with two or three women witnessing in front of a mirror if she's willing. And she may or may not disrobe. It's her choice. And really looks at her body. I've had people who looked at their body in the mirror and went, wow, I haven't looked for years. I'm looking really good.
Right.
You know, and people, we look at the little curls we have to adjust or, you know, the zit on our face, but to really look at the body and take yourself in and then share. And the women are very supportive, and often if you want them to say loving things, they will. And then we go into a place where each woman gets nurtured by that small group. And if there's things she wants them to say, positive affirmations about her body, they might say those softly while they're nurturing her in some way. However she'd like to be nurtured. It might be laying in the middle with hands above the body, or it might be just gentle stroking down the body, or just putting their hands on the body or holding. So we kind of bring up some of the fears and anxieties and hidden shame things about the body, and then create so much nurturing that they can disappear.
Well, now, women obviously have more body image issues than men do. But men are, more and more men, are, especially younger men, are trying to develop body image issues and eating disorders. Do you have classes that teach men how to love their bodies, or have you found a need for that yet?
We've just begun to do that. My work started with women. So my longer series that have more of these advanced practices has always been for women. And this year, starting this summer, I have a 3-weekend group for men and women. So we'll go into that, too.
Well, you were talking about creating a safe environment.
Mm-hmm.
Some of our listeners might be wondering just exactly how you do that. It might kind of sound intimidating to them and scary, the idea of getting in front of a mirror and possibly taking their clothes off in front of people that they've never met. So can you describe just a little bit about the safety and how you establish that?
Certainly. First of all, this is the second or third weekend, so they're people that they've not only met, but they've done exercises with, they've shared with in various ways, they've done a ritual with, so and they get to choose their group. So they're usually people they're pretty comfortable with, and there's often an assistant with each group, so that's someone that is therapeutically trained and is part of our staff. We always have like 4 or 5 people who are assisting with about 25, 30 people in a workshop. So there's a lot of support. And also we talk a great deal about how our body image issues are really things that we got from culture and we got from people who didn't know how to love themselves, and that releasing them is a part of claiming our body, coming back into being able to really live in it so we can feel eros and passion, so that it's a healing process. And part of how we create safety is we have many exercises where people are breathing with another person, looking into their eyes, the soul gazing process of Tantra, and sometimes with a hand on each other's heart and dropping into just this deep presence. And I think what happens when people connect with each other in that deep heart-centered presence is they recognize they're safe, because both people have their hearts open and they are safe. So it's actual experiences of safety that precede getting to an exercise like this that I think make it work.
So speaking of this, you do something called a puja.
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe that a little bit to us?
Sure. Puja is this word that can mean altar, P-U-J-A. It also is like a worshipful connection with another person. And it can be two people breathing together, maybe with their hands on each other's hearts, really honoring each other and seeing each other as a representative of the divine beloved. So we're really looking into essence to essence, kind of a soul-to-soul connection. And then the ritual we do called a puja each Saturday night of workshops is where you have many different partners like that. So one sits in the outer circle and one in the inner circle, and you're guided in a breathing process or some kind of exercise that comes from that place of deeply present connection. And so you're guided with one person, you complete that, and then you bow and honor each other, and then move to another person and another and another. And the tradition is that you partner with each person in the other circle and come back to your original partner. And you pick up another nuance of the tantra work from each person that you bring back home. We do have people who are couples when they come and they'd rather do the whole puja together, and that's also fine. It just means you keep deepening and deepening with the partner you've come with. So each exchange is a way of practicing erotic or romantic arts. So you're sitting together and connecting in the way that lovers might. And we think of it as practicing erotic arts without the story. So we make it really clear.
Got it.
Yeah. We make it really clear that when you're in the ritual space, there's a lot of permission for really opening to each other and having very intimate connection. Mostly close on, but very intimate connection. And that's possible because that's what we're practicing. But we don't make up stories about that. And if you meet someone at the grocery store that you had a puja station with, one of these exchanges with, you kind of start over. Because that's who they are out in the world. And in a puja, the agreement field is we get to practice. So we get to practice really opening energetically to each other, opening our hearts, breathing, the deep breathing, and also moving the life force in the body, moving kundalini. So it opens the whole body and can activate ecstatic states.
So, and let's talk about that, a little bit about kundalini and ecstatic states.
Okay. So kundalini
What is kundalini? That's a good place to start.
Kundalini is the life force. It's seen as serpentine, and the sense is it lies coiled in front of the base of the spine. Lies dormant until it gets aroused. It gets aroused in sexuality and is often that rush that people feel. They look into someone's eyes and there's this kind of rush up their body. That's kundalini moving.
Okay.
In the tantra practices, you can consciously stimulate that energy to rise up the inner channel, which is like the Buddhists call it the hollow bamboo. It's like an inner channel of light that moves up through the core of the body. The shashumna is another name for it. We like to call it the inner flute. And then each of the chakras is a note on the flute. And as you learn to move the kundalini, you learn how to play the flute, the instrument of your body. So the breathing helps to activate the kundalini, and then you have to completely relax so that the body can be open to it moving up the center. And there's an undulation that you learn that's really a pelvic rock. It's just moving right from the hips. So that undulates and calls the kundalini up this inner channel. And you use the power of the mind, you use imagery to help draw it up. So it comes into each chakra, and as it moves through the chakra, it energizes and activates that center. And each chakra has its own quality, but all the organs and systems in the body are connected to the chakras energetically. So you're, in a sense, feeding the body its life force as you learn to move the kundalini up this inner core. When you bring it all the way into the head, it activates brain cells, connects the right and left hemispheres of the brain, and creates ecstatic states. The tantra is the path of the ecstatic.
What is it? Is there a separation, in your opinion, between sex and spirit, or are they one and the same? How's that sort out for you? How would you explain that to people?
I would say that spirit is in everything, including sexuality. You can do sex and not really be connected to your spirit. And you can be spiritual and not be connected to your sexuality. So you're in the upper chakras, but the lower ones are pretty quiescent. And some people can be very spiritual in the upper, but not be in their sexuality, or they can be in their sexuality, but not in their spirit, not in their upper chakras. I think wholeness is having all of it. So then sexuality becomes not only an affair of the first and second chakra, but it becomes an energy affair of all the chakras. So you may feel the sexuality, you may feel a lot of sexual energy in your genitals, in your pelvis, and then you use this breath and you breathe it up and you take it into all your chakras and you open the sexuality to your spirituality. And you bring your light into your sexuality. And that's when it gets really fun.
Well, elaborate on that. What do you mean it gets really fun? You realize there's people listening who've never experienced this, so they don't really know what you mean.
Okay.
Maybe you can explain what is so fun about raising the kundalini through the different chakras?
When it moves into a chakra, it activates and potentiates that chakra. So, for instance, when you bring the kundalini into the heart, it activates neurotransmitters for empathy. So it allows you to be in empathic rapport with another person. So that's part of the pleasure, is by opening the heart, by letting the kundalini move through the heart, you're in a much deeper state of connection with anyone else you're breathing with, because it's activating the neurotransmitters for empathy. It's opening the heart to compassion. When you bring it into the throat, it opens creativity. It opens the true voice. And it allows you to expand your sense of who you are as a creative being, which there's a lot of pleasure in that. I also find that when you first start, you're breathing it up and it's moving a little by little and little by little. The more you practice, the wider the channel seems to open. And when it gets fully opened, it's like the kundalini moving sets off the river of joy in the body. And there's just this ecstatic, joyful, blissful feeling that happens when you learn how to create this energy moving. We use the term valley orgasm because you can move the energy in such a way that it begins to feel orgasmic in the different chakras, in that same sense that you might have a genital orgasm where the energy builds and builds and expands and just wants to keep expanding. That's happening. It can be happening in the heart, can be happening in the throat, the third eye, all through the body. And it's just very joyous. There's a lot of laughter with it.
Because one of the common misconceptions is that orgasm is just reserved for the genitals.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah. And do you teach fire breath orgasm?
Yes, I do.
Can you explain that to our listeners a little bit? What
sure.
is a fire breath orgasm?
Yeah.
Why would you want to have one?
The kundalini is also seen as fire. So the pelvis is like a cauldron of fire. And with the fire breath orgasm, you're learning to move it with quite a bit of energy through the chakras. And it really opens you. It opens this inner channel. It's like kind of burning away everything that's in the way of the the energy moving. And then when you, after you've opened it, because in the beginning that's kind of what you're doing. You're using the fire to burn away what's in the chakras, what might be blocking them from opening. Once they're opened and you breathe that fire up through, it takes you to very altered states of consciousness that are very pleasant.
I know, and I had a fire breath orgasm. I was in a class being taught by Jawala. Do you remember her?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I think she lives in Hawaii now, doesn't she?
I think so.
And it was very shocking to me because I was pretty skeptical.
Mm-hmm.
And it literally felt like a ball of fire shooting up from the sacrum, the base of the spine, out the top of the head. And I always joke, it didn't even stop to say hello to my genitals.
That's right. It had places to go.
It did. And that was very eye-opening for me because up until that point, I really thought that orgasms and genitals were, you know, there was some kind of an exclusive relationship there, and I know a lot of people still do.
That's right.
I think it's a little scary for people to understand that they can have orgasms just from breathing.
Mm-hmm.
Because it removes some of the barriers that we want to have in order to feel safe around sexual behavior.
Isn't it interesting that we want barriers to feel safe around sexual behavior?
Yes.
It's like we have so little trust in the area of our sexuality. In fact, we're taught not to trust it.
Wow, pleasure. Pleasure itself is suspect.
Right. Which is just amazing that we can share our pain, but sharing our pleasure is something we should be really worried about.
Yes.
I have a friend who calls this upside-down conditioning. There's something a little wants to get shifted there.
Well, and that's the nature of the culture at this point, isn't it? You know, the world seems mm-hmm. to be worshiping death instead of life.
Right, right. Yeah. We call our community sex-positive communities because that's, in a sense, the heart of it is getting to the place where you can love your sexuality again. Or maybe for the first time, where you can see that it's a natural part of the body. It's meant to be there. It's not a mistake. And the level of passion you can run is natural. It's meant to be. And then you learn, when you stop fearing it, then you can learn how to discern what to do with this energy and what's appropriate and what's not appropriate. You see, if we make it hidden away in the bedroom or in the closet, it's something to be afraid of, then we can never develop the skills to use it in a healthy way. And when we start bringing it out of the closet, you know, some of these exercises are scary, but that's part of what it's about. It's to get out of hiding and to bring our sexuality into our world and really get to know it, let it be the sacred offering that it's meant to be.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, some people are going to have a problem with that word sacred. What does that mean to you?
To me, that means that it has like an eternal quality to it.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of that it's meant to be. Sacred is honoring the essence of something. And when we see something as sacred, it's like we're in a yes to it. We stop marginalizing it. When you really connect your sexuality with spirituality, then you see that the pelvis is really meant to be an altar. It's meant to be a sanctuary for something that is so sacred it can take you into an awareness of the divine. I think part of why people study sexuality and have through the centuries, through the eons, is because the orgasmic state has the capacity to take you into union with the one being, with all that is. And we all have a hunger for that. whether we have language for it or not. We have a hunger for that place where finally we're not separate, even just for a moment. There's this great merging into oneness or into the void. And that's part of what makes it sacred. It's an energy that when you learn to use it as a resource, it can take you home, right into that place of union that is so satisfying to everyone.
You actually have a temple. Speaking of your sex-positive community, you have a temple.
Mm-hmm.
And do you make it available to couples for evenings and for retreats? Is that true?
I do. I offer a romantic evening for lovers, which is like a 2 or 3 or 4 hour evening, whatever people want. That
is that facilitated? Or
that one is facilitated. And then I offer the private room as a romantic getaway. So it's like a bedroom suite with its own bath. It can be a really sweet place for a weekend. Doesn't have to be facilitated, and there's 2 hot tubs on the land. Lots of beautiful gardens. And then we also have workshops, and people can stay overnight here during the workshops.
And you're located in Sebastopol.
That's right.
Which is in Northern California for our international listeners.
Yeah, it's about an hour north of the north end of San Francisco.
Well, we're just about out of time. So in the last couple minutes that we have, is there anything that you want our listeners to know about how they can reach you or about upcoming workshops or anything like that?
Okay. They can see our calendar on lovejourneytantra.com. That's the men and women's community. And then I have a separate women's only community, which is tantraforwomen.com. And they could reach me at 707-824-1118. I have a women's only workshop, which is called Evoking Divine Passion, coming up April 22nd to 24th. It's all the basic skills, but I also do an advanced track because I love having both people who are new to the work and people who've studied before in the circle. I think that's more the way the ancient temples were. And I have a co-teacher, Lindy James, with that.
That's
and
the feminine face of sexuality?
Pardon?
Is that the feminine face of sexuality?
She also teaches that, yes.
Oh, and okay.
She does some evenings here that are like support groups for women around the feminine face of sexuality.
They've actually got a pretty busy calendar here. You've got Introduction to Tantra, Circle of Radiance Puja, Creating Sacred Relationships, Erotic Energy and Intimate Communication, Introduction to Tantra.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, some of these look like they're just for the evening from like 7 to 10, and others are 6-month groups. So.
That's right. I have a couple in San Francisco in first weekend of April.
The 4th, looks like, the 3rd and the 4th?
That's right.
You're going to be at the Good Vibrations.
Yeah. And the one is on erotic communication, which is ways of asking for what you want so that people really get their needs met. And they love giving it to you because they feel really rewarded for offering what you're asking for.
Huh. Well, once again, if you want to check out Evelina Rose's calendar, it's over at lovejourneytantra.com. That's lovejourneytantra.com. And you can just click on the link. This is calendar, or you can do /calendar. And it's all right there.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a delight to talk to you. I really appreciate how deeply you went into the whole energy of self-love.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
It's been
a real joy to talk with you, too.
And I look forward to seeing you in person, I'm sure, sometime in the near future, because we're always running into each other.
Great. Lucky us.
Yes, I know. All right. Good night, Emelina. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. We'll be right back.
Thank you for tuning in tonight. If you liked what you heard and you want more solutions for your love life, please call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. Once again, that number is 888-903-0050. I am the only person who answers that line, and I am usually available Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also visit sexwithoutshame.com to discover more of what I can do for you. And remember, your secret is safe with you. Sering kesepian, kenapa tak mutus kabar berita?